Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on the Heritage Radio Network, every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45. Oh, yeah! We're back. Hey, guys.
How you doing?
It called in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Got, as usual, in the studio, Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing?
Good.
You missed me the past 2 weeks?
No.
We got Dave in the booth. How you doing?
Good. I missed you.
See? You know why he missed me? Because I took the Zoom with me, the Zoom microphone.
Oh, yeah. I saw that email.
And he needed it back. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm working over here. I'm working. I'm in Pittsburgh.
No, I knew you had one. That was just a call for all the other ones that I forget where they went to.
Where are people storing these things?
That's a good question.
I don't want to think about it. And we got a question in on pasta machines. And for that reason, my favorite fiddler of pasta machines, Alex Talbot from Ideas in Food, famously Alex Nacky, Ideas in Food, is on the line. How you doing, Alex?
Good, Dave. How are you?
Doing well. So I have him in on the line. So I don't know whether he's going to stick around past this initial question, but, you know, if he does, you might want to call in your questions. You know, you don't always get to ask Alex questions live on the radio. But Alex, let me give you the question. So for those of you that don't know, the Ideas in Food, you two have been working with the, how do you pronounce it anyway? Arcobaleno or Arcobaleno? How do you pronounce that thing?
Arcobaleno. Yep.
Yeah.
Sure.
So I think, you know, you guys were maybe the first people that I was aware of that were normal humans, you know, well, not normal humans, obviously, you know, you like a well-known like food people, but I mean, in other words, not like a restaurant or production facility that started using this kind of smaller format pasta extruder, and it's awesome, right? You love it?
It's phenomenal. I mean, they've got a number of levels of pasta extruders. It is the machine, I think, that changed what is possible for restaurants and restaurant kitchens.
Right.
You know, so
what's the throughput?
We started working with them.
What's the throughput on the thing?
Again, the more people that start working with it and tinkering and exploring what's possible with pasta, it has more people saying, okay, what if we did this and what if we did that? And then the demand for creativity and I think the demand for better grains and the demand for really exploring the entire landscape of noodles and pushing the boundaries of possibilities and the search for really the most amazing pasta you can put together is growing and developing.
All right, so let's just get some stuff out of the way so people know what we're talking about here. Your machine, like, costs roughly how much?
So the tabletop, the AX18, costs about $5,000.
Yeah, that's a lot. Go ahead.
Look, you put it on the same scale as a Paco Jet, and a Paco Jet is for ice cream and a few other things, and I think they're phenomenal. But I think with a pasta machine, you are actually printing money. You will have your return on your investment in less than 6 months.
Oh, no. For a restaurant, 100%. I think the person who wrote in the question, I think, is just an avid person at home who really wants one. So that's the market that's really, you know, not really being addressed because there's like it's a lot for someone at home.
So that said, they've actually retooled and created a pasta machine for that market. Still, it's expensive, but you can do 500 grams of dry matter.
Okay.
It's the AEX5, and that comes in at the lovely price tag of what, like $2,000.
And what is that? Like 750 grams of pasta or so?
You're going to end up with 650 grams a batch. So you'll have 500 grams of flour and the hydration at roughly 30%, 150 grams of that. So you're kicking out 650 grams of pasta at a shot out of the AEX5.
Which, by the way, is enough for a house.
That's totally enough for a house. In fact, I've got some friends that have small restaurants and are using pasta as just an accompaniment. They've actually gotten to 5, so they can make 12, 15 orders a night.
Right.
Of beautiful pasta. So it's small, but it is a workhorse. It makes unbelievable noodles.
Now let's just get some of the stuff out of the way. All of the inexpensive pasta machine extruders, rather, on the market, like that attach to stand mixers or that were made in the 70s, these are all garbage.
They don't work well. Look, they'll make a noodle. We understand that. But part of it is like, I used to have a DeLonghi years ago, like 2004, 2005, when we were out at Chia Grande. I found one of the DeLonghis on eBay and bought one and made noodles. Mind you, I was working on both flour-based and also exotic noodles. And it worked, but it wasn't something that it didn't produce. So you're sitting there just dicking around waiting for things to happen.
Right. I mean, it's hilarious actually looking at them, how slowly the pasta comes out. It's like a joke. It's like a bad joke.
Yeah, I mean, it's painful. I mean, it's look, sure, you can do it. Like, I used the KitchenAid attachment because I thought that was going to be my solution.
Nightmare.
It's horrible.
Horrible. Horrible.
So,
horrible.
I guess it's, you're not going to use a Yugo to race, in a car race.
That was my mistake the last time I tried to race car stars, was I got the Yugo for $400 and I thought I could win the race with it, and you just can't.
Yep.
Can't win the race with a Yugo. Here's the thing, though, right? So there's a couple of reasons that those things don't work, right? One, they're just not powerful enough, right? And so you have to use a relative, even to get the slow rate out of it, you need to use a relatively high hydration dough, so your noodles are never going to be as good, right?
Right. I mean, so you've got your increase in hydration, and you're not as dry, you're not as compact and put together. Again, noodles want to be the least amount of moisture possible.
Right.
And so when you're extruding it, and you can really cut down the hydration, your noodles don't stick together. People are always amazed, because when you make an extruded dough, it looks like streusel in the hopper when you're mixing it.
Right.
And it gets compressed in there, and there's a ton of pressure.
Right.
That turns it into a noodle proper.
And the problem with the high hydration along with the low force of the kind of crappy extruders is that even if you could dry it out properly, the surface just isn't very good of those things, correct?
A lot of it, you're not seeing the same surface, but you're not seeing, it's really hard to extrude a wet dough. It doesn't want, it's like trying to push, Jell-O through a screen. I guess Jell-O through a screen actually works.
Yeah.
I guess it would be more like, the Silly Putty through a screen.
Ooh, that's ugly. I don't want to clean the screen after I push the Silly Putty through it. Now, so for those of you that don't know how these machines work, you should check out the videos. But basically, it does the mixing for you, and then after you do the mixing, you start extruding. So it's like an all-in-one kind of a machine, right?
It is.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, hey, by the way, have you ever used, I was considering buying one, but they're like $300 and I'm on a complete spending freeze until we start shipping the Spinzols, when that works. But the, have you ever used one of those like Bigelly presses that you actually screw down to a bench and then you use what looks like a wine press to extrude those things? You ever use one of those?
Yeah. I mean, they have the beautiful allure of yesteryear. I am sure you would figure a way to retrofit it with some sort of drivetrain so that you weren't sitting there being the guy sitting there twisting it.
Right.
I mean, it produces a noodle, but you are the force.
That's not what Nastasia says. But the I think, I mean, that's the kind of thing you kind of want to do a couple of times, but you don't want to do every. You're not gonna be like, hey, let me make a Bigley tonight, right?
No, I mean, to go back to it, I mean, like, I will whip out the pasta machine with, you know, a half an hour before dinner and make pasta.
Right. Now, what is the deal with the machine with the extrusion? It's not the same as with a regular, sheeted pasta dough, right, in terms of rest times. That stuff just doesn't apply in one of these machines, right?
It's not. Again, and really, I think there's a lot of misinformation even about with, sheeted pasta and rest time. You know, a lot of what's happening is we're paying attention to hydration. So, you know, with the extruder, you're looking at it and you want the moisture to be absorbed by the semolina or the durum or whatever grains you're working with. Again, with sheeted pasta, I mean, that's why I say that, you know, if you got a vacuum sealer, you vacuum seal your dough and you can roll it right away because you're expediting the hydration. It's not like the gluten has to completely relax. It's not. The flour has to properly hydrate, and that's why you go from that opaque to that nice, rich, dark color that you get by the vacuum sealing of the dough.
Right. I always, when I want to do things kind of quickly at home, I always cheat into a higher hydration and then just flour the hell out of it the first couple of times, passes through the sheeter until it stops being tacky. And I know that that's probably not the best way to do it, but it is the fast way to do it at home. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I mean, you're cheating the system, but that dough, you better be cooking it right away, as opposed to I'm going to roll it out and put it in the fridge. Because you roll it out and put it in the fridge, and it's going to keep hydrating, and you're going to have a big dough mass.
Yeah, no. It's a right away cook, and you got to keep everything really separate because it wants to stick together. Blah 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 blah.
Yeah,
I mean, talk about pasta is like one of the moisture management, the miracle of moisture management problems that there is. But anyway, so this is all about the machine. And so the reason I'm prefacing all this to the question that this poor guy from Montana wrote in is that a miracle of these machines is not just the extrusion, but that they also facilitate the proper mixing of the dough, and that to make the dough in a separate machine and then feed it into an extruder might be more difficult if you had, let's say, a KitchenAid as your primary mixer. Do you think that's true, or do you think that's false?
I think it's actually, you can actually do it. And I know a number of chefs, Gerard Kraft out at Pastoria, he's got some larger arcobolenos, and he makes, 200 pounds of pasta a day at his restaurant? So he uses a larger Hobart and dry mixes his dough and then just drops it into the hopper. So he's always staying one step ahead and can do it. So on a smaller scale, yeah, you can do it. You can mix your dough in a KitchenAid and then kick it into something else and extrude it.
Yeah.
And again, he's doing that, so he has so much production that it makes sense for him just to go from one to the other.
Right.
And he's just constantly feeding it.
Oh, because he doesn't want to waste the time to have it mix instead of just being extruding 100% of the time.
Exactly. So he's got his extruder literally extruding all the time, and he's just adding more dough to it as it continues to run out, so he can go nonstop.
Right. Now, you know Johnny Hunter out of Madison, Wisconsin, right, chef?
What's that?
You know Johnny Hunter out of Madison, Wisconsin, the chef in from Underground Meats in Madison?
I lost that bit a little. I'm sorry. You're a bit staticky on my end.
Oh.
So.
Yeah, Johnny Hunter, the chef from Underground Meats, friend of the show out in Madison, Wisconsin, he uses – this is more preface to this question. See, I'm a big believer in multiple prefaces to every question. He uses his large Hobart meat grinder as a masa grinder, which I've never tried, but I know a couple other people that have done it. Basically, what I'm prefacing here is that the actual real Hobart meat grinder is strong enough to extrude masa dough, probably strong enough to extrude pasta dough, right? So here are my questions, because here I'll read you now poor guy from Montana's question. Since you guys are professional restaurant equipment producers, designers, I want to ask you a question that has been driving me crazy. Why doesn't anyone make brass plates to stick into a meat grinder and extrude pasta with? A number 12 hub meat grinder is cheap. I would use the – anyway. A pasta extruder is expensive. Could I get a machinist to fabricate some brass plates from my cheap Chinese Hobart attachment and extrude pasta to my heart's delight? Poor guy from Montana. All right, now here's my thoughts, and then you just go off. Ready? One, meat grinder auger, slightly different from a pasta auger. The pasta augers I've looked at on the web have a constant pitch rather than kind of an accelerated pitch like a meat grinder has. That's one. Two, you're going to want to remove the cutting blade off of the end of the meat grinder auger and replace it with just a spacer, because you're not going to want that cutting force right behind your extruding die. But other than that, I think it might actually work. What do you think?
I think it'll work pretty much without a problem. I mean, you're fixing the problem sort of. So I guess you're allowing yourself to get to where you want to go. But if at the end of the day you want to actually make pasta, you want to get the pasta machine. If you want to adapt it for a couple of days or a year or so to see if it works, but I think if you're going to start to make pasta, you're going to have such a demand for it that to be jerry-rigging your meat grinder to be extruding pasta dough is not a long-term solution.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In a restaurant, 100%. But, like, let's say that your handle is literally poor guy from Montana. And, you know, you already own the grinder because, like, you know, like 2-3 times a year you grind a whole elk through it. Because, you know, the elk is running through, trampling on your garden anyway. So you shoot that elk right in the heart. You grind it through your Hobart. You have the Hobart sitting there, you know. You don't have a couple of grand. I would bet that you could find because here's the other thing. Like, I don't know a lot about the plate sizes in pasta extruders, but there's several different plate sizes. And on eBay, you can get individual pasta plates for, like, the dies for, like, I don't know, I forget, like $100, right, Alex? Something like that.
Yeah.
It seems to me that you could probably have someone make an attachment for the Hobart that would at least let you try it. And obviously, if you were going to do this professionally, you know, obviously, you know, you want to go professionally. But I think you might be able to get some tests. But I do think you'd need to remove the blade. Do you think so, or do you think the blade wouldn't be a problem?
No, I mean, if you look at the small meat grinder attachment anyway, the smallest die that they make, that's almost like a beagle-y, right?
Right.
So if you have one of those kicking around, I'd throw dough through it first and see what happens. I think it'll work.
But on the dies for those things, don't they? They're chamfered, aren't they? To kind of like gently extrude to the face surface. Like they're not. It's not like a. It's not like a deep through all the way through, isn't it? Or no?
You said the pasta dies kick out. Yeah, they stick out so you can cut smoothly.
Right. I mean, in other words, like, I think it's a little bit more difficult to extrude. In other words, like, if you were going to extrude something through a plate and it went from being, you know, completely unextruded to the final hole size and then had to traverse the entire length of the die at that diameter, I think that's going to be a lot harder for the machine to handle than if it's chamfered in the back and then, like, only has to pass through that thin place once through a small, you know, a small distance of going through that thin area. Don't you think so?
So it depends on the shape. So, like, a spaghetti die on the back of a spaghetti,
yeah,
it's just all those holes.
Huh.
It just pushes the dough through it. But for, let's say, shells or something like that, it's got that smaller bit, so it downsizes the dough, so it can actually come out as a shell.
Huh. Now, do you think that, I know that, like, for various texture reasons, yada, 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 you know, brass is the material of choice, or bronze is the material of choice for these dies, but do you think that the stainless steel plates would work just as a test to see how well it would work?
Absolutely. I mean, look, you've already decided that you're going to run pasta dough through a meat grinder. I don't think we need to, you know, get meticulous about getting a bronze die.
All right. So as a first test, poor guy from Montana can, like, take the blade out of the back, just put a bushing on it to take up the slack and see whether or not he can push it through the medium or the I don't know how fine the plate he has, but just test it to see whether it works.
Exactly. I mean, there's an eighth of an inch, which will be like a thick bigly. So I'd give that a shot. I mean, they also make one for juicers, right? For like the slow revolution juicers. They make pasta plates for those. Again, home style, but so it's, that's not too much of a difference than a meat grinder as well.
Right, but I'm assuming poor guy from Montana wants to use the like an actual proper hydration dough. The other thing I'm concerned about is, isn't your pasta auger longer for its diameter than a meat auger is?
I think it depends on your darn machine. I mean, the auger's pretty big, but it's pretty big hopper, so it's taking dough from the whole space.
Right, but in other words, part of the actual compression and hydration is happening in the augering procedure. So I think it's
pulling it in, but I think it's only in the neck of the machine where you're having it happen. I think it's literally the dough is just dropping in earlier on.
Right. But is the neck longer for the diameter of the auger than it would be? Because like a KitchenAid meat grinder, which I'm no fan of. I love the KitchenAid, by the way, but I'm zero fan of their meat grinder. The auger is extremely short on that and also plastic. So I don't know that you're going to be able to generate. I don't know that you have the time to get the dough in the proper consistency from that crumbly thing to being perfect dough, you know, in the traverse time of that particular meat grinder, because the auger is so short, even if you had enough power to, you know, overcome it. You know what I'm saying?
I do. I'm trying to think. So our meat grinder that we use the LEM meat grinder.
Right.
Which has got a big auger. I mean, but it spits meat out super fast. So I think it'd be interesting to see how it kicked out dough.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it would grab it. But I wonder if it's almost too fast. You want something moving a little bit slower.
Huh, and you can't, they're not meant to be changed. Here's another thing, by the way. So poor guy from Montana is using a Hobart knockoff from China. And something I will tell you about motors is that a lot of motors really, 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 really do not enjoy being loaded beyond their stated capacity, right? And so I guarantee you the good people at the Hobart Corporation have taken into account the fact that everyone and, you know, and their sibling is going to completely and utterly abuse their product. In most commercial, like actual name brand commercial restaurant equipment that I've ever used, you can beat the ever loving crap out of it. And you might flip a thermal, you might melt a safety off, you might, you know, boil water, you might burn your hand on the motor, but afterwards it's going to come back to life. Like knockoff versions, like I often find, like, you know, they use cheaper gears, so you might break the gear in a situation because a pasta dough is a lot of freaking force. You know what I'm saying? And so you want slow extrusion with extremely high force. And so, you know, you might run into problems with the Hobart knockoff there. Whereas, as you're saying, you know, with like the real ones, it's either it's going to work or it's going to not. It's going to be too fast or it's not. But I wouldn't worry that I'm going to destroy the machine, because I'm presuming it's built with a level of quality that can withstand that. Whereas, if the thing might be like a complete champ on meat, but then you try to shove something that's really hard into it and you fry it. It's like my Nixtamatic, my masa grinder, you know, churns through masa like a champ because that's what it's designed to do. But you put peanuts with sugar. You know how when you process sugar and nuts together, it turns into like basically concrete. Alex, you ever done that one? Like it the paste turns to like concrete, because I was doing it to try to get maximum oil extraction, and it seized the machine, and then like the giant puff of smoke out of the back. It came back to life, thank goodness. But you know, you have to when you overload something, you have to be careful, especially if it hasn't been designed with thermal protection in mind. Just a, you know, little tip.
You want to take another call, Dave?
Yeah, we can keep Alex on the
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
All right, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Scooter in Montana. How you guys doing?
Oh, hey, are you poor guy?
No, I'm not poor guy.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I love that we have at least two people in Montana that are listening. That's amazing. All right. What's your question?
Oh, you got more than that.
Oh, nice.
So I have a bag juice question. I like to do my burgers low temp. I throw a little butter in the bag, maybe some garlic. When they're done, I have delightful bag juice, which is usually about half oil or fat and half liquid. Then what I tend to do is brush it on the buns and grill the buns. And it's delicious, but there are two problems. One is sometimes using the brush, you end up with just oil and just water. So I solved that one. I added a little lecithin and blended and emulsified, but it's still really, really runny, and so it makes the buns really soggy. So what I was wondering is there a way to get that juice into something resembling a mayonnaise or a spread that I could spread on the buns before hitting them on the grill?
Well, I mean, Alex, I'm going to let you chime in for a second, but a lot of the a lot of this, especially if you're doing this in kind of a service restaurant situation, when I was working with juices out of bags or anything like this, sauces on braises, etc., typically what I would do is I would use yesterday's bag juice to work with today's product. And what that does for you is it gives you some extra time. So then if you have that, you know, fat from yesterday, then sure, you can make a mayonnaise out of it, you know, like traditionally, like with egg white. You can do whatever you want. You know, you can pre-boil the bag juice to get rid of the extra scummy proteins, strain it all through with the liquid, you know, take an egg yolk, mayonnaise it, or use any of the kind of more modern techniques to do it, and then use yesterday's product on today's burger. And, like, that's the easiest way, because I find that most of the interventions that are going to let you do anything rather than just brush it on aren't I'm just going to do this while this thing is, you know, finishing or getting ready to go out, because it just takes a little more – it's just a little more frantic or hectic if you do it that way. Alex, what do you think?
Well, since we're speaking with you about and on the line about it, that actually sounds like a prime use for your Spinzol, in the sense that I would take all the juices and run them through your centrifuge, have the fat, have the liquid, and have the scum. Take the fat and the liquid, and then be able to make my beautiful mayonnaise with the fat and the liquid, and then get rid of the scum in one shot, and then just have this great production.
Right, sure, but you would use yesterday's product. You'd use yesterday.
Oh, yeah, you have to. You can, I mean, there's no way you're pulling it and going. You've got to get at least one day ahead. So the first day somebody gets screwed, they don't get quite the same experience.
So I'm just at home here, so I understand that's maybe not a possibility for same day service. But what would be your technique? Let's say I do have some bag juices from yesterday, and you're talking about some more modernist ways to. Or just traditional ways to whip up the mayonnaise. What would be your technique there?
Well, if you let's just go back to your actual problem for a sec. So if you're trying to do it with today's product, right?
Yeah.
What I would do is I would the issue with mayonnaise in general, other than it is delicious, is that you want to stay within the proper ratio of fat to liquid. So you're going to want to stay about 80% fat or thereabouts. If you go too much more liquid than that, it's going to get too thin. If you go too much, a lot more fat than that, isn't that right? It's about 80%, right? And then if you go too much above that, it could break. You're going to get that shimmery look at the top and break. So what you could do if you want to do this on the quick is you could pre-start a mayonnaise, right? So if you take an egg yolk, and you know, you pre-start a mayonnaise, but don't like let it stay thin, but not broken. Don't fully mount it up to its full capacity. Then you can dope your fat from the bag back in along with the mixture. Alternatively, because if you read Harold McGee, an egg yolk can really take a lot more oil than we're used to. Let's say your bag juice to fat ratio is around 80% in that range, then you can pre-make a mayonnaise fully mounted up, right, to mayonnaise texture. Then just whisk your whole garbage together and then into the mayonnaise, and it should hold it. I mean, I would test it. You know, Alex, what would you add to stabilize? Would you add anything to stabilize, or do you think this would work? I think it would work. Did we lose Alex, Dave?
Sounds like it.
Oh, maybe he'll call back in. I think it'll work. Mayonnaise is a little bit hopefully he'll call back in. Mayonnaise can be a little bit tricky. I mean, when we used to teach the class with Harold McGee at the FCI, we would make a gallon of mayonnaise out of one egg yolk. And it's always a little bit trying, like, you know, it's like we always get like really close to a gallon and then it would finally break. But you know, like you can do pretty well. It's just about keeping your liquid to fat ratio proper. And also, you know, obviously you have to add salt and whatnot, or mayonnaise is god awful. And it's nice to have a little acid in it, or again, mayonnaise. I don't like mayonnaise without some acid in it, because it's just then it's in kind of insipid garbage. I've never made a mayonnaise with butter. I don't know why. Maybe because I'm a low quality individual. By the way, Dax is working on the low quality individual shirt, Nastasia. So we can sell another 3 t-shirts.
Yeah.
But the there's a famous recipe. His name just went out of my head, but he was the might still be, for all I know, the head chef for Valrhona Chocolate. Famous guy. I don't know why I can't remember his name. And one of his like kind of famous recipes is a mayonnaise made with cocoa butter, with like chocolate and cocoa butter. And he has to keep that mayonnaise kind of at the right temperature, because once the cocoa butter solidifies, the mayonnaise breaks. And so it's like keeping it warm, but it's a warm mayonnaise. And so, butter takes longer to solidify than cocoa butter does, but you're probably going to want to keep it in the range where the butter is going to be fluid, because mayonnaise is built around a fluid oil, obviously, but not so hot that you curdle the egg yolk. You know what I'm saying?
Right. And well, especially because some of the fat in there too is the rendered beef tallow.
Right. And that stuff gets waxy real quick. So, in fact, by the way, this is one of the reasons that I really like to. So, low temperature meats in general, steak specifically, I often like to finish with liquid oil like olive oil. One, because I find it delicious, like a finishing oil, like a, you know, Italian style. Stas, you like that, right? Like a steak with olive oil on top. But also because just adding a little bit of liquid fat on top of the steak helps prevent that waxiness that can happen if you let pure steak on steak action like sit around too long and congeal. And nobody likes. I mean, I don't know. Maybe somebody likes that waxy. I guess on a roast beef sandwich, that waxy texture is what you're looking for.
But well, I hope not.
Yeah, but, no, but you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm talking about, that waxy. You know what I'm talking about, that waxy.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's something that I like when I, you know, cook potatoes or something in tallow, but yeah, I obviously want a steak.
Yeah, no, you don't want a steak. So anyway, but I want you to try that. Hopefully sometime you'll try that, and then like I'd like you to let us know whether or not it worked, and then we can futz around with it more. It's difficult. I mean, you can thicken the water base of the of this stuff, right? And then if you emulsify it, the entire thing will be thicker, but it ain't going to be mayonnaise. You know what I mean? I mean, mayonnaise is like, you know, a minor miracle. Like, I love mayonnaise. It came to my attention a couple of years ago that there's some people that don't like mayonnaise, and I just don't understand that. Like, you know, I just don't get it, because mayonnaise is like such, you know, a miracle kind of a product. But anyway, let us know how your mayonnaise test works. Oh, the main fat thickeners that people use to thicken fat, I don't happen to like them, because the ones, at least that I have used, require a lot of to like thicken the stuff up properly. And
even GMS.
Oh wait, wait, you're back, Alex.
I am. I kept getting dumped out. I was going to say GMS. You can use a small amount to thicken the fat up, for sure.
Yeah? Is that available at modernistpantry.com? Ah, sponsor.
I'm thinking it's got to be.
Yeah. Well, what percentage do you use?
Shoot. I think it was like 1%, if not less.
Really?
You were able to. And you can make spreadable mayonnaise, spreadable chorizo oil, anything. Yeah.
Oh, well, so try that out, because I never really played around with that. Like, you know, back when the last time I worried about this was literally 10 years ago. And, you know, and all we had then was like mono and diglycerides, and that stuff is nasty to use as a thickener. I mean, it's awesome stuff, but it's nasty to use as a thickener, because you're using like 5-6% of mono and diglycerides to thicken your stuff up. I mean, Alex, am I wrong about that? Have you had any good luck with that stuff? No, right?
No, the GMS is worked out really well. I got it, as you said, it was about 5-7 years ago. We were really working with it as a thickener. Mono diglycerides, I haven't used in forever since. And so as a true thickener, but I look at more as an emulsifier.
Yeah, no, it's great for that. Better. But like, I remember back in the day when everyone was trying to figure out what to do with this stuff, when it first became, you know, available, you know, people were doping it directly into oil at huge rates to actually thicken the oil. But not only is it nasty at those levels, but like the texture is wildly temperature dependent. And so, you know, you'd have, it would go waxy super quick as it cooled off. You know what I mean? Yeah. So anyway, so any of those things could try. So traditional mayonnaise, or you know, whatever, you know what Alex is talking about. How, what percentage did you say, Dad?
I was looking at 100%. I'm trying to go back to my notes, and if you give me 30 seconds on this new thing called the internet, I can look on our website.
Ooh, nice.
I certainly have it from years ago, but let's see.
I see. Well, Alex is searching. So hopefully this is helpful, and you will have great success either using a traditional technique or a modern technique, and then let us know how it works out.
Yeah, well, in the meantime, you guys should come out to Montana. You got fans out here.
Really? You know, I've never been to Montana, but I hear it's, like, intensely beautiful out there.
We get some 1%. Nice stuff.
Wait, what'd you say, Alex, 1%?
1%, yep.
Yeah. So like,
and it melts right into it.
Yeah. So
right into the fat.
Cool. So theoretically, I love Montana, but I've never been. Stas, you ever been to Montana?
Montana's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Stunning.
Where were you guys used to be? You guys used to be in Colorado, right, Alex?
We were in Colorado for 4 years, and then we actually spent the season out in White Sulphur Springs, running a private ranch out there as well. So,
where's that?
Hey, no kidding.
Is that in Montana?
Montana, yep.
Are there, in fact, White Sulphur Springs there?
White Sulphur Springs? You know, I don't know. We were stuck on the property, so that I'm not sure. We went from the property to Bozeman every once in a while for ingredients.
Nice. Yeah, so no, I'll go sometime. Sometime I'll get to go.
Excellent.
Anyway, let us know how it works.
All right, Chal, thank you, good both.
All right, thanks.
Dave, you want to read that thing real quick, and then we can take another call?
All right, Alex, are you staying with us?
Yeah, I got you.
All right, cool. One sec. I'm going to read a little, I got to do a little bid naz. Today's program is brought to you by Modernist Pantry, providing magical ingredients for the modern cook. For free videos, recipes, tips, and tricks, visit blog.modernistpantry.com. All right.
Oh, I meant the longer one.
Oh, man. I'll read the long one on the outro.
Let's do it.
Oh, okay, I'll read the long one now.
You got 10 minutes.
Okay, business people. This is what is known in the trade, although trade implies that we're being paid for this.
That's true.
Which is just not the case. But anyway, this is called the mid-roll ad. Modernist Pantry is created by food lovers and cooking issues fans just like you. Janie, Chris, and the Modernist Pantry family share your passion for experimentation and have everything you need to make culinary magic happen in your own kitchen. Professional chef, home cook, food enthusiast, no matter what your skill or experience, Modernist Pantry has something for you. They make it easy to get the ingredients and tools you need and can't find anywhere else so that you can spend less time hunting and gathering and more time creating memorable dishes and culinary experiences. Visit ModernistPantry.com today to discover why Cooking Issues listeners call Modernist Pantry the cook's secret weapon. Be sure to check out their new Kitchen Alchemy blog at blog.modernistpantry.com for free recipes, tips, and tricks. And don't forget to follow Modernist Pantry on social media to keep up with what is new and exciting in the world of culinary ingredients and tools. My God, my mouth is so full of spit from not stopping in the middle of that. All right.
Well done.
Okay, we have a caller. Caller, you're on the air. What do you got for us?
Hey, Dave, my friend and I are working on a mojito pavlova.
Okay.
We're going to do like a lime curd and then infuse the meringue with the mint. What's probably the best way of going about the meringue part?
Alex, you done a lot of work with meringues or no?
Yeah, I mean, look, the simplest is I'd make mint water.
Huh. Well, how much?
And use powdered egg whites.
Huh. You hearing that, caller?
Powdered egg whites. Okay.
Yeah. So here's the trick with powdered egg whites. Powdered egg whites come in various different qualities. So, way back in the day, I'm talking like in the 90s. I haven't researched it recently. Like a lot of egg white, dried egg white came out of China, and it had like very particular properties as opposed to other ones. I forget. It was really liked for certain things and not for others. But recently the powdered egg whites that I've seen are all relatively neutral, relatively clean. The issue with the powdered egg white is you want to allow proper time for hydration. Am I wrong about this, Alex? Or
no? Again, it still wants to be properly hydrated. But when we were flavoring things, for sure it was using again, powdered egg whites, so we could use a flavored liquid, an intensely flavored liquid. So if you're trying to make, like, you know, the mint pavlova, I'd be using, again, a concentrated mint tea or liquid, and then the powdered egg whites and to make the make it happen.
And by the way, go with the mint tea. It's like buying commercial mint tea is the easiest way to get a relatively stable liquid mint flavor, and then dope it with mint oil. Actually attempting to get, because mint oil is real and mint tea is real, trying to take mint from the garden and getting a stable kind of mint flavor, I find to be exceedingly difficult. Have you ever had any like perfect luck with that, Alex? Or no, I think it's really hard.
No, it ends up tasting so grassy and so, like the it doesn't work.
Right. So mint tea has been like good, proper, like, you know, like Moroccan style mint tea has been dried. Once it's dried, my impression is that it's relatively more stable. And then it's being steeped in hot water, which also makes it relatively more stable. But you will not have the freshness that comes from the oil. It'll be a different flavor, which is why I would dope back in a little bit. Because I guess the oil theoretically will destabilize the egg whites, but a little bit's not going to kill you. But I would dope it in for freshness. What do you think, Alex?
I like the two-step process there for sure.
Yeah,
because that again, anytime we can layer those flavors together, I think we're in a better place.
Peppermint extract or whatever. Sorry.
Wait, what'd you say? I couldn't hear you, caller.
Peppermint extract. Do you think that would do the job, or just the straight oil?
I wouldn't use just straight oil. I would use, because the oil is a certain portion of the mint flavor, and a lot of that's the flavor that you would lose from cooking the mint, from blanching it, which is what's going to be happening when you're making the mint tea. You're going to get more of a cooked mint flavor. I really think if you want an integrated mint experience, especially if you want that color from the mint, that you're going to want to do two steps. You're going to want to buy the mint tea, steep it, and then add the oil. If you want just mint flavor, sure, you could just use regular egg whites and dope it with a little mint oil, you know, after it's, I would say probably after you've whipped it. Wouldn't you say, Alex? Probably after you've whipped it, I would stir it in and pipe it. What'd you say?
It's not going to want to whip otherwise with the mint oil in there.
Right, and it's going to kill it somewhat, but like once it's stabilized with sugar, you should be able to get a little bit of it in, which is all you're going to need, prior to piping. And yeah, you could fake it then with color, but I think you're going to be just have like a much more integrated experience if you make the tea and then use the powdered egg white. And by the way, like you can have a portion of it be powdered. So like, Johnny Azzini used to use a lot of powdered egg white in conjunction with actual egg white when only a portion of the liquid base needed to be highly flavored or needed to be bolstered. So, you know, it's not an all or nothing proposition.
Yeah. And the other thing you can do is actually dust the meringue once you've got it piped out with dried mint.
Oh, that's a good one.
So almost like you do like a green tea, but have your dried mint and powder that guy up and just dust it over
like
it.
Okay.
And then I guess a final option would be if you again nitro muddled your mint, right, and then folded that into your meringue.
Well, nitro muddled mint though, still unless it's blanched, is going to go really.
It's going to go black on you.
It's going to go black. So you have to blanch it first, and as soon as whole mint hits heat, it loses the magic of fresh mint. It's not that it's not delicious anymore. It just, it's not the same. It doesn't have that hyper fresh, but honestly, like another thing you could do is you could do a nitro muddled mint or a dried mint into the meringue straight without worrying about it. And then after it's cooked, mist a small amount of the oil on the top to get that. And that'll probably also give you a lot of the mint, because it takes a minuscule amount of mint oil to bring that mintiness out. So, you know, if you find that, like, adding even a little bit of mint oil to the meringue, you know, makes the meringue, because, you know, it's, I'm sure, you know, both of you have seen it. You add, a little bit of oil and you get a lot of bubble popping. It's not that it's not as much of a disaster as, you know, the old cookbooks would lead you to believe, but it's definitely not your friend for, like, a meringue that's stable enough to sit there and pipe and then bake out.
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't have any access to nitro yet. I'm working on that. But hey, what if I brought an ISI into it? Would that do anything, or would that be is that a waste of cartridges?
I mean, I don't really see how the ISI is going to help you in this situation, since it's not really an infusion problem. I think it's also not really a whipping problem. I think egg whites are a lot better, you know, except for cocktail style egg whites. Like, meringues are a lot better, like, with a beater. You know what I mean?
Actually, and what would be interesting is, I mean, you can play around with this, but if you took fresh mint leaves and let them sit in your egg whites for a day in the refrigerator and see if you can infuse your egg whites with mint flavor that way.
Yeah, I mean, okay. you could try, as long as the real issue is, like, you're going to want – the problem with the mint is that, right, most of the oil, that flavor stuff, is on the bottom of the leaves in these little kind of like – these little kind of like, you know, whatever – I forget the name of them. These little, like, oil things on the bottom of the leaves.
Like vesicles?
Yeah, and then the issue is that mint is perhaps the most susceptible to leaf damage in terms of flavor, that swampy, spinachy, grassy flavor of any common herb. It's the most susceptible. So, like, you know, and if there's any oxygen around it when it's doing its thing, then it's going to go kind of swampy on you. So you might want to, like, if you have a vacuum machine, if you wanted to try an infusion in your egg white of fresh mint, I would definitely try it under a vacuum to try to get the oxygen out, because there's enough residual oxygen in a mint leaf to make it go swampy just on its own as soon as it starts getting damaged, because it's going to get damaged from being under the liquid. I mean, you know what I'm saying? What do you think, Alex? Don't you think so? Vacuum is the way to go here?
I think so, and I think you're probably going to get maybe some more flavor out of it as well.
Right, but
I think,
but vacuuming egg whites is a hilarious procedure if you have somebody else doing it. You have to be, like, really, you have to really look at your bag, because once egg white starts boiling, the bubbles don't pop readily, and so your bag tends to fill up pretty quickly with bubbles. So you're going to want to use a way oversized bag. And you're going to want to have plenty of room in your vacuum chamber, and you're going to want to keep your finger on the stop button so that you don't.
Right.
Otherwise, it's going to. I mean, it's kind of a toss as to what's more of a pain in the butt, egg whites or milk for this kind of a thing. But, you know, they're both kind of pains in the butts in a vacuum machine, at least in my experience. I don't know, Alex. Do you have any tricks on vacuuming those things, or just watch out because they're a pain?
I'd watch out, and I'd have somebody else do it. That way they can clean the machine.
Right, and then what you do is you look at them and you yell at them, call them incompetent, even though you would have done the same thing, and then force them to clean it. That's always the way.
Would you blanch them or anything before the fresh mint? Would you
no.
rinse it or blanch it?
No. Well, here's why. If you were going to,
we got
to
wrap it up then, Dave.
If you were going to blanch it, then you can do anything. Once you blanch the mint, then, you know, all bets are off. You can do whatever you want. You could blend it. You could, you know, roll it into a cigarette and smoke it, because, you know, you've already lost the stuff that you're trying to keep in there for having it be hyper fresh. So, I mean, Alex, you might disagree with me, but I would say that if you're going to blanch it, then I would just don't sweat it. Just blend it and add it to your egg white and beat away. You know what I mean? At the end. Like, fold it in. I really like the powdered dry idea. Like, really finely powder it in a spice blender, and then fold it in at the end as though it. I think that actually is a nice way to go. And then maybe misting with a little fresh mint oil afterwards. Do you think, Alex? That might be the easiest of all of it. Without, or like your idea of making the mint tea and then with the egg white. That's the most integrated. But if you didn't want to go through the pain in the ass of doing that, your idea of powdering the dry and then maybe with an additional. Little bit might be good. What do you think, Alex?
I think so. I think also if you spritz it just lightly with the oil and then dust it, that it's going to adhere to it really nicely as well.
Oh yeah, on the outside. So, I was thinking he could do on the inside of the pavlova as well, like in the meringue proper. But I guess just a dusting also would be nice.
You could, yeah. I mean, folding. I think that's both are solid. I think they're. I mean, they're, now you've I think delivered a bunch of different ideas to try and explore. It's like, you know, how many of them do you want to integrate is the question now.
Would you say that we've given him some ideas in food?
I think some ideas in food. He's going to have to deal with his cooking issues, but he has plenty of ideas in food.
All right.
Well, hey, we got to get out of here, Dave.
Love you both.
All right, thanks. All right, well, listen, well, I didn't get to all the questions today, but thanks so much. I have a question on tonkatsu broth that we'll get to next time in pressure cooker. Alex, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's always a pleasure to have you. We'll be back next week with more cooking issues.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.